Welcome to our podcast.
It's not prod.
I can't.
It's pod.
I think I need a speech language pathologist right about now.
Let's try that one again.
Hello, SL peeps. Welcome to True Confessions with Lisa and Sarah. Okay, can start confessing now. This is so cheesy.
Well, hey, Lisa.
Hi, Sarah. How's it going?
It's really great. I don't like that you're not sitting physically next to me, and I don't see your presence.
No, you like it. You like it. I always say I'm your barnacle. The barnacle and the boat need to separate every now and then.
No, but we got past that. So yes, in the early days, yes, it was a lot of togetherness. And then I needed some space because I'm an only girl and I don't know how to share and I've never had a sister. So I did struggle, but then we spent enough time apart that I miss you.
And you're going to come see me next week. So all is well.
So tell everybody where you are.
I am in Colorado. Chilling in that, to me, I keep saying that I'm a reverse snowbird because we're based in Arizona and I am looking for snow and wind and cold temperature, but only seriously, temporarily.
What is wrong? Do you know what it is right now today, temperature wise in Phoenix?
What?
It's about 70. It's gorgeous.
Sounds
hideous. Absolutely stunning. What temperature are you in?
It's not bad. It's like 40.
That sounds hideous.
Ugh. And I found out that with their seasons here, it's like there's winter and then the next season is mud season because all of the snow starts to melt. So I've been testing out the four-wheel drive in my Hyundai Palisade. My Hyundai. And apparently the four-wheel drive only helps incrementally because I've been doing a little slipping and sliding and gasping and a little bit of, I probably shouldn't even talk about that. I was a little concerned for my life a couple times next to a ledge,
no.
But that's okay.
I have been so proud of you from this experience though, because I don't drive in rain. So I certainly am not driving in snow. And you have just embraced this frozen pipes and all.
Well, no, frozen pipes, the way that they're still frozen. I'm waiting on something to come, not just a plumber, but something to come that we can put on the pipes. But in the meantime, I'm filling a bucket with snow and letting it melt inside. And then every morning I dump it in the toilet to flush it.
Wait, is this going to happen when I'm there next week? Regular plumbing.
No, it'll be fun. And then the other thing that I was really proud of myself for like getting through and like, you know, I literally was patting myself on the back is I picked up this blanket off the floor in the living room and a dead mouse fell out.
Oh, is that going to be gone before I come back?
I mean, that one will be. That one's up. Yeah.
It sounds rugged, but I'm here for an experience, Lisa.
Yep.
And
yep.
You know what? You've invited me and I'm your guest. I'm excited. Exactly. All right.
Okay. Enough about
We could do this all day long, but do you want to introduce, we have somebody else in the confessional with us.
Yes, I'm so excited. We first met this guest via SLP Summit that we did in January. And I'll just say her name and let her introduce herself because I'm sure she'll do a much better job. But we have Rachel Archambault in the house today in the confessional. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to see you both again. And I remember the last time I officially met you guys was right before my SLP Summit presentation. And I remember just talking to you both and going, really, guys, Carol Westby right before me? Like, who did that? Whose plan was that? So that was a tough one to follow. But I loved talking to you then. And I was like, oh, these girls are fun. So.
Well, and I love the contrast. Again, Sarah's just bragging on her 70 degree weather. And you're in Florida and you've got a tank top on.
I checked when you said 74, it's 84 degrees right now and it's 3:54 and it's hot out and I just want to be in a cabin somewhere.
Come next week too. Book
perfect.
A ticket.
Yes.
Perfect. We'll make it a big fun time.
It's a real quick trip for you from Florida to Del Norte.
Very, very.
No, it's Del Norte. They say Del Norte here. They don't even pronounce it Del Norte.
Oh, okay.
I'm in Del Norte. Yeah. Welcome to Colorado.
Oh, Rachel, this is so fun. So yes, that is true. That did happen. We did have you go after the queen. And afterwards, when we were talking about it, I said, there's no accidents here. Like, we just will have these like kind of presentation days where like, we're just like, oh dang, that was a great day. And it was amazing. For those who did not join us for SLP Summit, tell everybody what your kind of the presentation was about.
Sure. So I presented on trauma-informed care across all speech settings. And trauma-informed care is kind of my thing. On Instagram, I'm known as the PTSD SLP. And I found through a tragedy, trauma-informed care, I was looking for a way to work with my students after they had gone through tragedy. I had gone through tragedy. And for people that don't know, I worked at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in 2018. I was there for 6 years from 2016 to 2021. And there was a major tragedy that happened there. So after that happened, I was like, how do I work with my students? And that's where I found trauma-informed care off of the Google machine. And I started doing my own research and seeing how I could best apply this as a speech pathologist. And there was nothing specific to speech and trauma-informed care. So for the last 5 years, and just 2-3 weeks ago was the fifth anniversary, I talk about trauma-informed care. I present at FLASHA every year. I hope to present at ASHA this coming year, and I will be
speaking. Yeah, ASHA.
Yes.
Come on.
ASHA Connect, I will be at. So that's a school-based conference. But when I have presented at FLASHA in the past, a reason that people have not come to my sessions that they've told me is that they thought it was a school-based issue, or they didn't know that it was for them, or like they didn't know what trauma-informed care was. They thought it was related to TBIs or something like that. So I wanted to make it very clear for SLP Summit, trauma-informed care for SLPs across all the settings.
And I will say in the chat, there was a lot of gratitude for you broaching the topic. I think somebody had mentioned something like the only time they've even seen anything like that, even presented through like the ASHA leader or whatever, was in reference to vets. And so working with vets who had trauma, and that's not what trauma is. There was a lot of definitions of trauma.
Well, that was one type of trauma, but there's so many. I know, even when you were doing the course, again, we get so busy while courses are going on with the kind of the back behind the scenes and technology. I literally was just like, nobody can see me right now because I forget this is a podcast, but I was just all ears because we've all experienced trauma in a variety of ways or whatever. I had no idea. I will tell you, I went into the presentation pretty naively on, again, like, you know, why do I need to know this exactly? Right. And first, personally, eye-opening. But then to think of, I always have had a really good rapport with my students and shown care and taken time to get to know them. But I never realized the impact of their lived experiences or things they've gone through and how that's going to affect them in my therapy room.
And I think most people are in the same boat as that. And I was sent the feedback after, so I look through every single one of those, which I find constructive criticism so helpful. So there were things that I definitely could explain a bit more, or taking out interjections that I use. But
okay, I was just going to say that when you had told me, because you're like, no, I want it, and I go, all of it. Because Lisa and I have literally done kind of like what Jimmy Fallon does with mean tweets. We have done mean comments that are so unhelpful and ridiculous.
We use Snapchat filters and put it on our Instagram stories because we think it's so funny.
That's what
we
make ourselves look funny.
Yeah, you need to.
That was my plan. And then I was like, I don't want, like, from my trauma-informed brain, I was like, I don't want... That's the problem with it, is my brain is always on that. I was like, you know what? I want people to ask questions in good faith, but some of them, the comments that really bothered me, I calculated actually 99% were positive. It was positive. Yes. And then the other 1% were neutral or just did not understand it, did not get it. And I think for that population, they do not want to get it. One of the comments that stuck out was, you talked a lot about Oprah. That's a big turnoff for me. And I was like,
what? You said what? Didn't you say one thing, which is about the book, which the book, I love?
The book.
You talked about it's what happened to you.
Exactly. Instead of,
which, again, I have so many takeaways, but that one was huge for me because I do. And again, I naively say stupid crap all the time out of just ignorance. But I would say all the time, like, what is wrong with you? Like to somebody in a sarcastic way. Right. And then when you brought that up about that, like, we don't want to say what's wrong with you. We want to say what happened to you. And then you talked about that book. And I was like, oh my God, what a shift in perspective. Like I heard that and I was like, oh shit, I got to stop doing this. Like joking, what's wrong with you thing. We've all had these experiences that have changed us and made us who we are. Anyway, but that's the only time you brought up Oprah.
It was. And that's what, right. And what? I was sent the video today that I'm going to review it. And I really want to like write down and tally how many times I say Oprah, because I need to know. But it was comments like that. That were just another one that cracked me up was you lost me at bullet points, which if you attended the session, I talked about violent language. So violent language is just, we're SLPs and we talk about figurative language all the time. So there's things in our vernacular and our each dialect that we speak, we have these phrases that are just violent for no good reason. So when I had a list of just examples, and one of those are bullet points, or the one that I hear every single day is shoot me a text, shoot me an email. So if you do know what I've gone through at my school, and then you look at all these gun specific, gun violence specific phrases,
yeah,
you're going to dial that back or just be like, wow, I didn't realize how much I said it. So one of the best takeaways is I can't even tell you how many like hundreds of messages I got after the presentation that people acknowledging the fact that they use that in speech that they never knew before. And that's all I'm asking them to do. I'm not expecting them to just say, nope, automatic, I can't use these words anymore. It's just acknowledging how often we use these terms in our language and how that can inadvertently maybe hurt someone. I'm not saying it causes trauma, but when you hear this constantly, it might re-traumatize, it might re-trigger someone. And that's that. We're just trying not to cause harm. That's the whole point of trauma-informed care is we are service providers, and then you can also use it in your everyday life. But I don't want to cause unintentional harm to anyone.
Yes. Even the word triggered. When you started talking about that violent language and kind of our English language is fascinating. And I'm going to half the literal figure, our figurative language things we use don't have great histories. Mm-hmm. I never thought about it. So instead of saying, oh, I have never thought about that. Now, great. One more word I can't say. Oh, guy. I mean, like what? What am I going to say now? Like I have to censor everything I'm saying. No, I took that as I never thought about that before. And I want to be conscientious of, I don't know who I'm talking to and what their, you know, experiences are. I'm going to start thinking about these things. And so even the word trigger, because I use that all the time to talk about like something that triggers you.
Exactly.
And it does, whether it makes sense to somebody else or not, we all get triggered by different things and we need to be conscientious of that. And if we are aware, we should definitely not be trying to trigger someone. But even the word triggered, I loved what you talked about with that word. Yes.
Which is why it's being suggested to use the word cue instead. However, the medical terminology has not followed yet. They're not changing trigger to cue. So I try to use them interchangeably, but then I also think the word trigger is, you know, there's people that have a problem with like trigger warnings and everything. It's just like unnecessary political correctness. And I saw something about that last night that made me.
I did too on Instagram.
Yes. So I think that there's a negative connotation of why we use trigger warnings. And just that word, like you were saying, Sarah, is a term, it's violent. So there are other words that we could use instead, but I'm not saying that, oh, stop using these because they'll cause people trauma. It's just to acknowledge how often these are used. And I don't think if I didn't explain where my trauma comes from, if that would make such a difference, you know, because all I put those specific examples for a reason, because they are connected to my specific trauma. The people that you're going to have in front of you, you're not going to know what trauma they have unless they disclose that to you. So there's other types of figurative language we use that might apply to them, or just things that you say that are, you might know that you're triggering someone, unless they tell you, and you shouldn't have to know what someone is going through for you to have to change your language.
Well, and even if it's hard, like I get what you're saying too, Sarah, the idea of like people saying, oh, this is one more thing on all the things that I have to change. I think the awareness alone is the thing that if you have to change one thing, it's that, you know, words have impact in a lot of different areas. And so if you say something, and if you notice a shift in the air, the energy, a reaction, something that maybe you're like confused by, reel it back and think about these things. And if you wouldn't have had a course like this to even have that kind of awareness, we shouldn't be thinking of this like as a punishment to like, you know, be aware of things. These are people's everyday lived experiences, and we should try to be empathetic to that, especially as speech language pathologists working with, that's her whole job, is to work with people.
And I think it's very important to say that it is applicable through all speech settings. And I talk a lot about, you know, if you're working in the medical setting, which I haven't done in a while, but if you're working in the medical setting, a lot of times your clients, your patients are there because they have experienced something traumatic, perhaps a stroke that brought them to you, that, you know, you're working through cognitive skills or language, anything like that. And then if you have two patients in two different rooms, one of them was a neurosurgeon and, you know, they're doing Sudokus post-stroke. And then you have one next to you that's not able to do anything. If you're the provider that goes in and says, oh, well, at least you're not that guy, like be grateful for that you're able to do a Sudoku. That's not trauma informed, because it's not our judgment of someone else's trauma. We shouldn't judge that. But what also is that now a financial concern for this person that they're not able to support their family, or is it a loss of independence? Are they able to talk to their spouse? Or that, you know, there's all these things that we have to consider and be mindful that it may be a traumatic experience that brought these people to us, and to not see it through our eyes. Trauma informed is supposed to be taking one's individual experience as trauma and just going with that.
Somebody even said in the comments, you had so much, you know, it's always interesting in courses when we do live courses and we do summit with such a large audience. There are courses that I think people are just digesting, so maybe the chat and questions are not as active. Mm-hmm. In your session, in your course, the chat was ongoing, because I think what people who weren't hung up on you talking about Oprah were really getting from it was this idea of connecting not just with their students. Like, you had people that said, you know, I work in middle school, and so my, you know, that trauma can be, you know, all of these things that my kids are going through, you know, that they're experiencing from their family issues, or their parents just got a divorce, or they're homeless, or they're being bullied or sexually harassed or assaulted, or racism. I mean, there's so many things that can trigger trauma for an individual. So they're sharing that. But then you had a lot of people too that were talking about their personal trauma as providers. As you're talking about things, they were really relating, because people were sharing things in that chat, which that to me, for them to have felt safe in context of your course and in context of this group, was a beautiful thing. But somebody had even mentioned that, you know, pain is pain. We can't, you know, there shouldn't be a comparison of pain. This isn't a contest. You know, it's just that, you know, again, going back to being aware, being empathetic, trying to understand perspective, even if you don't have that same lived experience, in whether it be somebody you're working with, or a colleague, or a family member, or whatever the case.
Right. And I can't remember if I mentioned it in the presentation, but there is a theory within the trauma research about big T and little T trauma. And I think I totally throw that out, because it is assigning a number along with the ACEs study to a specific trauma. So if you say a car accident and I have 30 people in a room and you say rate it 1 through 10, some people are going to say that's the 10 worst experience ever. And then you have people that, you know, assume a fender bender or like not a big deal and they've never experienced it. But then you might have the opposite. So it's important not to say, and for me, for my trauma that I talk about publicly, people say that is the worst thing ever. Like people come up to me at conferences all the time. And they're like, I can't imagine what you went through. That is the worst thing ever. And it doesn't compare to my trauma. And they usually tell me what their trauma is. And I'm like, I don't know. That sounds pretty bad to me. Like, and then I also like tend to joke in the conferences that I'm like, I think dating in South Florida might be more traumatic than what I went through. So I don't know.
Dating in Arizona is the same. Maybe in Colorado, I'll have better luck here. You never know.
Yeah. But no, it's true. It's like all of these things that it's personal experiences. And when we use our personal experiences to judge it, and I can't tell you how many times growing up, people use that toxic positivity and they say, oh, you know, it's not that bad. It'll be fine and whatever. And I think we're so uncomfortable with human emotions other than happiness that it's always like, cheer up. Don't make me uncomfortable. Get back right to that baseline of happy. Yes. And it's like, we are able to be sad. We're able to be angry. And that we have to acknowledge as humans ourselves, not even just speech providers, we can get dysregulated. And that is a major focus of mine now. And I'm doing more research on it because I'm not a parent, but this goes into parenting styles a little bit, which I touched on in the summit, but there's ways of regulating yourself before you have to work with another. And that's how I relate it to the parenting styles, is because I work with students and could be with elderly people as well, but I have to regulate myself. So I realized for me, I can't work in a private practice with little kids because of the screaming that goes on. That is a major trigger with dysregulation that I cannot control, and I cannot have a good session in there. It's not going to be useful. So I need more of a quiet space, and I'm doing administrative. I'm a speech program specialist for Broward County right now. So I oversee 38 elementary, middle, and high schools, and I help the SLPs at all those schools. So I go out, I work with the SLP, but I make sure I'm regulated before I can work with another person, because I cannot, if I am dysregulated, I cannot regulate someone else. And if I am triggered, I need to know how to regulate myself. I need to identify that I am triggered and how I can bring myself back to regulation.
Yeah, the gentle parenting videos that you shared were triggering for me. I told Sarah because it made me realize what a crappy parent I was. And it's too late now. My kids are
too late. It's
too
late.
They just had to have what they have. And, you know,
we were both so disappointed that we just now learned this and we have adult children, because we want a do-over. We would like to approach things differently.
Grandkids, that's your do-over.
It wasn't a thing back then. It wasn't. Like, I have discussions with my mom, and I think if my parents had raised me with the gentle parenting, which is a misnomer, it's authoritative parenting, not authoritarian. Authoritative is the technical term for it. But if I had been raised in that way, I think that would have instilled so much more confidence in myself, a better relationship between my mom and I. And I want my students to know, as part of the pillars of trauma-informed care, we want to promote safety, encouragement, trustworthiness, transparency, all of these things. And by speaking to our students, our clients a certain way, we can foster that relationship. And I'm trying to now kind of make, I don't want to say it again, gentle SLPing.
Yeah,
I know. That was it.
Authoritative SLP.
Yes. SLPing.
As soon as I said it in the summit, I was like, oh no. But no, I was cracking up. But
and I teased you that we were going to make that quote.
I know. I saw it flash across my mind. I was like, that's going to become the quote that's on the Instagram tomorrow. But I'm trying to relate the two. Like, I want a chart of the parenting styles as SLPs. What does that look like for us? So that's the thing that I'm working on right now. But I think it's just so important to know how we talk to someone, that it can make a difference. And I'm sure that if I had a room full of SLPs and I say, have you ever triggered someone, most of them would say no.
Daily.
Yeah. But that, you have to acknowledge that, yes, you have done that before. And it's unintentional a lot of times. But if you are the person that jumps to saying, no, I've never hurt anyone's feelings unintentionally, that's not true.
Yeah, no.
And it's tough.
There is something about the personality of an SLP. Because even the toxic positivity, when you talked about that, I probably drift into that because I am overly positive and, like, you know, I want to make things better and improve things. And I got in trouble in grad school. I will never forget with the adult rotation for being, you know, trying to fill in silence or trying to make things lighter or more pleasant and more experiences for people. And thank God my clinic supervisor was like, don't do that. Stop. Like, this isn't about you. And you're like, silence is good, and stop trying to fill it and stop trying to make this experience fun for everyone. Like, these are adults going, and I'm like, oh crap, I didn't know I was doing that. I just thought my smile and charm was helpful. It is not all the time. And so, no, I think that is a personality trait where we do think, because we've got these great communication skills and we're people, mm-hmm. that in and of itself is all we need. And even as an adult, I will tell you, I am just now doing the work where I'm realizing I've got some shit coping skills. And I'm a Gen Xer, and I have seen a lot of TikToks that have represented, I love my parents, but they didn't do a great job with validation, talking about emotions. You know, we swept a lot of shit under the rug, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm realizing now, like, oh crap, you know, there's some things that I've got to work on. And so that's it. I think that's it. It's the acknowledgement of, yeah, we've got some things we can work on and improve, and how our dysregulation shows up.
Yes.
And affects other people. And I saw that so much when I was parenting my kids. I literally went to a course that somebody taught, because I had a really tricky son who was quite challenging. And
is
I had
it
to go take this
consequences or something like that.
Oh, what was the other one? And is I know cool? I almost don't want to say it because maybe I don't even know if it's, like, still a positive thing or not, but it was love and logic, I think.
Oh, that's what it is. Yep.
And I don't even know what the research shows on it or now, but this is 20 years ago. And at the time, it was all about that. Okay, remove yourself. Like, why are you losing your crap on this 4-year-old kid? Like, go take a time out and chill out, and then come back in and be calm and give him choices and, like, all these other ways to, like, engage with my son. I literally had to take the course like 4 times because I thought I was learning a new language.
That does sound very similar to what they are saying now. And if that's a parenting style, that's what we should be doing, because we work with patients and clients with very challenging behaviors. So we need to be able to take a step back and say, I need a second. And I played a video about it, that, which was another comment I got, enough with the TikToks.
No, I want to talk about the TikToks.
Okay.
I loved the TikToks.
And so did 99%, I think. Yes. I think, again, this is another thing that TikTok as a platform has a negative connotation, that some person just wrote, I hate TikTok.
Okay.
And I was like, but did you get the purpose of the video? Like,
I didn't ask you to sign up for an account.
Right. No.
The purpose was not I was marketing TikTok. I was showing you an actual example of what something looks like.
Right. And it's also like saying, I hate YouTube. Like, it's it's the platform in which content is spread. So you might not like things that are on TikTok, but if you go on mine and they joke about the algorithm and whatever, it is parenting styles, dating coaches, speech stuff. And that's it. because the more I like, the more it shows me that. So if you see other weird things on there, you're liking some questionable things. But
TikTok. Look in the mirror, sister.
Exactly. But I think there's a negative connotation of it. But I wanted, I mean, I wasn't telling anyone how to parent their kids. I'm telling people how there is a way of talking to people, and the theory behind some of the parenting is trauma informed. The parenting styles are trauma informed, and we can implement that in any setting. And it's just adjusting our language to make sure that we don't cause harm. It's the same as a parenting style. Change your language to make sure you don't cause unintentional harm. That's it.
Did you show things again? Oh, sorry, Lisa, real quick. I want to go back because I know I loved when you said we want to promote safety, transparency. What was the other things?
Do you remember? Trust. Yeah. Trust, collaboration, mutuality. And then, so these are all the pillars of trauma-informed care. And there's also cultural, historical, and gender issues is the last one. So of all those things, you can check off, am I providing this in the session? Do I understand the cultural implications? Do I understand that my client feels safe right now? And that's a really hard one. The safety one, I think, is the most important, but also the hardest one to reflect on, because it's a women dominated field. Number one, we're carers. We want to support these children. So when we say, oh no, I didn't provide a safe atmosphere, and that doesn't mean physically safe all the time. That means emotionally safe. And if you're being dismissive, if you're saying get over it, if you're doing all these things, is that promoting a safe session? Not necessarily. So that's a really hard one to reflect on, but it's just, and it's also hard for you to answer, did my child, my student feel safe? We don't know unless we ask them, and maybe asking them isn't going to give you the correct answer.
Because they have to feel safe to say no.
Right, right.
So it is such a, like, it's a weird thing. And then even the safety thing too, it doesn't have to look as overt as I'm not telling them, like, you know, get over it. It could just be that I'm not somebody that has shown through my actions, my words, my behaviors, whatever, that they could be safe. So how would you ever know? So it is a lot of self-reflection in trauma-informed care, but, you know, that we have to kind of understand where we can be a part of the solution, but also a part of the problem. You know, everybody is.
Right.
It's not personal. It's everybody has their things that we need, you know, all can improve on.
Right. And safety is such a difficult term to define as well. So I think of when I was working in the high school, you would have a teacher that a student says, like, oh, hey, you know, my parents are getting a divorce. And then next thing you know, it comes to another teacher and they say, hey, this teacher told me that your parents are going through a divorce. And although that was helpful for that teacher, that might have broken that kid's trust. We don't know if the person they told is a safe person to that kid, and that just damaged your safety relationship between those two. So it's a very difficult thing to evaluate yourself for, but it's the most important one, because if someone doesn't feel safe with you, with your room, learning can't happen. We know that from Maslow's hierarchy.
Yes. So good. I was just thinking of one of the, I don't think it's one that you should, let's talk about TikTok for a second. I don't think it was one of the examples you showed, but I had seen another example of, the mother walks in and the toddler has cut her own hair, and watching this mother's reaction, I was like, somebody give her an award for mother of the decade, because she did not flip the frick out like I would have.
Right.
It was very much like, what'd you do? Do you like it? Like, very, it was just the whole thing. And I thought, oh my gosh, how can I get to a place where I'm not overreactive? Cause I am, I'm just a reactive person, but it was just like the coolest thing to see, like, somebody, I guess what it was is, I don't think I realized that when I did that, because I would have been like, what the heck were you thinking? Give me those scissors right now. You look ridiculous. And now let's get you to the salon so we can fix this. Because I don't want everybody thinking my child has terrible hair. But it was like, who cares? Why does it matter? And I don't want to inflict something on this child where in the moment they realize it's not safe. I can't explore. I can't, like my mom's going to lose her crap. And so I want to like change the way I do things so that I don't ever get that reaction from her again. Like, oh, it was just like, I think it's the coolest thing.
And
it takes, but how do we do it if we don't just take Xanax all day?
Right. It takes such restraint to do that. It's so hard. And I think that's what people say is this takes a lot of practice, a lot of restraint, and it doesn't just come naturally, but I could imagine me being a child in that moment and know exactly that's how my parents would have reacted is, what did you do? We're grounding you for 10 months out of this, you know? Oh, yeah. And the consequences didn't apply to the crime, you know, that it was like, the consequence could be a natural consequence. Well, you have a bad haircut for the next months, or, you know, there's something else, but that is the natural consequences, having a bad haircut. For me, it probably would have been grounding for an unreasonable amount of time and not feeling good about it, or associating my looks to how I make others feel. And that is
we're going to cut all your hair to that length now.
Yeah.
Oh, did you like that? Now we're going to like shave your head. You know, like these, again, I just love what you just said, the natural consequences of things. And this is where I think a lot of us get, now I feel like this is turning into a parenting thing, but it is, it's that idea of like the kids not doing well in school, especially like my daughter in high school, she doesn't pass her class. She takes it again. Why would I ground her for 6 months? Mm-hmm. Like, she's going to miss out on all of these things and experiences that are important to her life. And I grounded her for 6 months because she's failing. Well, no, the consequence is you don't graduate and you're taking summer school.
Right. Yeah. And what are the reasons behind the failing? Is it that she needs extra tutoring? Is it, you know, because I am terrible at math, and I think as speech pathologists, many of us are. And I just could not get it, but yet I have my master's. Like, it's not that educationally I don't understand. It's that math has always been a challenging subject for me. So when I was punished for failing a test, I was already punishing myself about it, you know? So that was really difficult, that I needed like the love and encouragement. And also, let's take the parenting out of it. If we are a speech pathologist, and we're sitting in a session with a preschooler who takes one of those plastic scissors and cuts their hair, are we allowed to shave their head? No, we can't.
So, you could. You might get fired.
Right. But, so we have to then put some of that. We have to take the parenting out of it. What would our response be in the classroom, in a way? How would we address this? And I think it would be different.
Oh my God.
That was parenting styles.
That was so powerful what you just said, because you're right. Guess where I was awesome? In the classroom. I used to literally think to myself, I wish I'd treated my own children like this.
Oh, I thought this, I used to do home health, and I had my parents, my whole family, my brother, my parents, and everyone laughed because I worked with this one kid. And again, at work, you remove all of your emotions that you've connected to your own child. And this family was like, we really want to just hire you to be like his nanny. And I was like thinking to myself, so I came home and I told my parents, cause I'm like, no, I'm real good in those like 1 hour stints. Don't give me like a long period of time with this child, because then I lose my ability to self-regulate. And so we all got a good laugh about that, but I do think that somebody wanted me to be a kid's nanny. But the idea of like, when we think of like do-overs and stuff too, I think, was it Tipa Snow that you showed a lot of TikToks? I thought that was an interesting dynamic too, because, you know,
so good.
A lot of us are going to have do-overs with our elderly parents. And she had a lot of examples of working with people with dementia and Alzheimer's. And I thought what was interesting in that too, again, throughout this whole presentation, where people were commenting, like, if I had only seen this 6 months ago when my own, when I was going through this with my own mother or father or whatever.
Yes. I saw a ton of comments about, my dad has Alzheimer's and I'm going to approach this differently.
Right. And there's two ways of thinking about that is one is goal oriented is, I want, one of the videos I showed was about like changing the shirt with the stain on it. So how do we get them to go where we want to go? And do we cause a big scene about it? Do we possibly add more agitation to it? Or do we just leave it because it's not really a big deal? So that's where it comes into regulating ourselves, right? Because again, type A SLPs, we want things to look a certain way. If we're going to a family picture, we don't want a big old stain. But also, I think it would be hilarious looking at a picture that you just remember that huge stain, you know? And then it's also, we don't want to traumatize them. So I talked about it in the summit that if you have someone who already has memory concerns, right, and they might not know who you are, yet you're telling them to take their shirt off, there are traumatic things that could, traumatic experiences, or you might unintentionally harm that person. And I think a lot of people might say, oh, they'll forget about it in 10 minutes. They'll forget about it tomorrow. And that is not the right way of thinking of things, because we could also apply that to a baby. We could say, they're not even going to worry about it. You know, they won't remember this ever. So I think it's just acknowledging that trauma exists and what happens. And it's important that, I think, Lisa, you brought up in the beginning about we always associate trauma with veterans. And even I attended ASHA, they had a town hall like 2 weeks ago. And a couple people on the panel were from a VA, and they talked a lot about military. And I want to get away from talking about that, because we all the research is done with veterans, with PTSD. We don't need to know more about that. We need to know about everyone else that also has this happen, and how it looks.
Or in use that. That information to support other individuals with different kinds of trauma. That's absolutely not the only type. Yeah, exactly. I agree. You're right. There's so much research there now.
There is.
But we're not applying it to anything else.
Exactly. So a lot of the research that we have with PTSD and trauma is from military, which is awesome, but they are also signing up for a job that might have them experience trauma in a certain way, you know? Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and certain types of trauma that we might be able to predict what types of trauma might happen or what kind of PTSD. And I tell the story that, I don't remember if I said it during the summit. I talked to, we have ROTC at the high school, and the year after everything happened, we had a new ROTC teacher. And I remember him sitting at the meeting of welcoming everyone back in the beginning of the year. And we had all these mental health professionals giving us trainings, and the guy just raises his hand and he was like, now, how do I know which kids have PTSD? Because he wanted to focus specifically on them. And I pulled him aside after, and I was like, I understand the intentions that you have, and I understand your big, beautiful military brain that you are looking for the diagnosis, but you have to treat every single person on this campus as though they've experienced trauma. And just because you've experienced trauma doesn't mean that you have PTSD. It's the PTSD is the disorder part of it, that it just keeps you on edge all the time. But it's just, after that, he was like, I never thought of it that way. And he changed his language for those students, you know, everyone.
Oh, so good. Because you're right. It's the way you're reacting to the trauma. Mm-hmm. And so, again, this goes back to big T, little T. It's different for everyone, but your reaction also changes. And so I think it is just that general awareness. I know somebody, I don't know if you mentioned it in Summit, but I saw it in the chat too. And I just actually got a copy of it from my therapist. The body keeps the score.
Yes.
So just because, you know, some people are coping with things better or a reaction or whatever, our body does not forget things. Mm-hmm. And so you might have a reaction to something and you're not even quite sure why you're reacting physically the way you are.
Yeah.
And so trying to process some of that. So again, I think with our students, especially those who may struggle with the verbal language to talk about what they're feeling, you know, it gets kind of complicated. And I guess that was going to be my next question is, okay, so we know this, we know, you know, that definitely a lot of our students and individuals we work with have experienced things that is impacting their life, in a negative way. But what do we do other than making sure we promote the safety and transparency and trust and collaboration and
mutuality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And the cultural and historical and gender thing and being aware of all those things, because you kind of mentioned it at one point during the summit. we're not diagnosing trauma.
No, and we're not detectives of it either. We don't need
detectives of it. That's what you said. Yes. Yeah.
We don't, we are not trauma detectives. We are not trying to have a group of preschoolers and say, what are your traumas? Like, we're not trying to find any of that out. By being trauma informed to everyone, we shouldn't need to find out. There are definitely extra steps. If you, Douglas is an example. My school was an example. We knew the trauma, one trauma that most people had experienced, but that also doesn't mean they didn't experience a trauma before or a trauma after or a trauma at the same time. So there was just one type, like the violent language we could remove on campus. But there are other things that might be going on. It's a really difficult thing, but I want SLPs to know that our biggest advantage is having good relationships with mental health counselors, mental health professionals. So that's the counselors, psychologists, anyone that's on your team. It doesn't have to be in a school. If you work in a medical setting, you have a lot of people on board that can help you with this. But if you are at a school, you have all these people that you can say like, hey, I kind of heard something about this kid through the grapevine. Is there anything I should know to better address or help? Not that, hey, I want to sit them down and say, hey, I heard about this, because that might not be what the child wants, needs, or finds helpful. So it's always helpful to pair with the mental health professionals so they can guide you. And a lot of the stuff that I'm looking at right now, I'm looking at like therapists for dummies. Like, I'm trying to be a therapist, not really, but I want to see how they speak. I want to know how I can implement some of the things they do in speech practice, because there are takeaways of just, I know from being in therapy for so many years, my therapist doesn't offer suggestions. She just listens, and then she will help, you know? So it's active listening. I want to learn how to do that better. And we can do that as speech pathologists, especially as people who need, we want communication. We want our clients.
Yeah. We want them to talk to us.
Yeah. It's an opportunity, right? It's an opportunity for communication. But when a client tells you like, hey, I'm having a hard time right now, you can say, look, I'm here for you if you want to talk about it. And you nod your head and you acknowledge what they're saying. You validate what they're saying and let them continue talking to you, rather than, you know, taking down notes and you're like, oh, well, I'll look into this for you. Or,
or trying to fix it.
Yes. Yes. You can say, do you mind if I reach out to like the school therapist about this? Like, this is the collaboration part, right? So we want to be able to collaborate with our clients and not have that power trip that we are the providers, but we are also on their team, and it needs to be more of a team effort. So I think that's really hard for a lot of people as well.
Yeah. I had a little guy I worked with who was a first grader. I probably have mentioned him on the podcast before, because to this day, it's been so impactful, but he was six, and his behaviors were disruptive and extreme, and it caused the entire school, I think, was quite, everybody was talking about this kid, which I hated and tried to shut down often as possible. But anyway, I just kept like thinking, again, he's six, and there's severe trauma there that is what has caused a lot of these outbursts and you know, aggressive behaviors that he's doing. And where's our compassion for that? But the whole goal was to, he needs to go somewhere else. He's disruptive and dangerous, and he needs to. And I remember at that time, and this was 10 years ago, just thinking like, that can't be the right solution. Like, it was the most, and Lisa knows, she was my supervisor at the time, and I probably called her every other day in just frustration. I didn't have the solution. I didn't know what it was. I tried so hard to implement, like we did the behavior plans and tried to like give support to the staff on, you know, how we should engage and help him and all of those things. But that's a tricky role as the SLP a lot of times, to support students
and to get other people on board. Yeah.
Yes. So I mean, do you have any advice on like our role, I guess our role in this? Like I, to this day, I think, did I fail him? Like, did I, you know, did we, but I was one person, you know, trying to change the perspective of a staff of 50.
Right. And that's with my new position, I love that I'm able to work with new SLPs, CFs, and even some that are a few years into it. They come in with such an intention to change speech or be the best speech pathologist they can. But I also remind them that the systems in place, specifically in my district with like the school system of, I'm in Florida, no caseload caps, massive caseloads, behavior concerns, large classes, everything like that. So I say, I understand that you want to be the best SLP that you can, but you can only do so much. Like you have to take care of yourself. You have to advocate for yourself as well. I'm a big proponent of just like going to administration and tell them, I cannot do this. I cannot do this with what you are burdening me with. And trauma-informed care cannot happen when the systems in place do not acknowledge trauma. They do not help us, the employees. So you can only do the best that you can on your end. If you are providing trauma-informed care, that's what you can do. And that's the level that we can control. We can advocate for those above us. We can advocate for our employers to have trauma-informed trainings so that they understand. But it's a really hard thing to do because of all these pressures we have as speech pathologists, even in the medical setting, when you have 90% productivity you have to follow, is that your best care? Is that your best therapy? It cannot be. If you're saying that your best therapy happens at 90% versus 60%, that can't be possible. So yeah. If we had the time allotted, if we didn't have these time constraints, we could provide better care. And that should be the goal, is not the other parts of the system, you know?
Yeah.
Rachel, I feel like we could talk to you forever.
Because I love when you just said that about the system. We talked about that was it Kelly Percorson or somebody else?
I love her. I love Kelly.
There's been a few times that exact, oh, maybe it was Nina Reeves. We talked to her about this too, but the system has set us up for failure kind of idea. And so I love that. I what I always hope when somebody's listening to the podcast or some presentations is that not that they walk away going, oh God, one more thing, like I've got to be conscientious about, or I'm not good at, or that I've got to think about when I'm trying to do all these other things. And it's not that. It's just, again, like learning and growing and being a good human and trying and doing your best. Yeah.
Totally agree. Like I said, but Rachel, literally, I feel like we could sit here and talk to you forever, but this has been such a fantastic hour with you. And we really, really, really appreciate you sharing your experiences, your knowledge. And hopefully for people that are listening, if you didn't catch Summit, this gave you a little bit of context to go out, and we'll put some resources in the podcast episode notes as well too. So,
and seek professional development opportunities on this subject.
Yes.
I think it's really important now more than ever. Yeah.
Yeah. And even just reading, I mean, I don't want to mention Oprah again. I'll get in trouble, but like,
I'm putting that book in our show notes.
I think that is, again, I recommend it for a reason, because it is the most introductory course with actual good information. The Body Keeps the Score is a much tougher, rougher read.
Yes.
It is more heavy into the brain, like physical nature of it. And it's very taxing. So I would recommend the other book first, but just, I think those books are important for you to acknowledge that trauma exists and how it can be best acknowledged, I guess.
I think our feedback would then just be for your next course that you do, please do a TikTok of Oprah.
I will. I'm going to do a Snapchat of just Oprah's face all around mine. And
that'll be the border of your slides.
No, I'm going to have to reach out to you both to help me like plan these, like
the mean tweet.
Yes, please.
No, literally, we'll help you if you want. Please. If you want
to publish this,
nothing brings me greater pleasure.
We could do another podcast where we just read mean feedback. And here's the deal. Again, I'm with you. I love constructive criticism. Mm-hmm. Please tell me. I want to learn and grow and become better. But you telling me my facial expressions are distracting and you couldn't listen to the words coming out of my mouth, not helpful. Can't control them.
Right.
I've been doing this for 42 years.
Right. And I also acknowledge that, I mean, most people said, love the videos or loved the conversational nature. And then you had people that were like, or hated the conversation. And I was like, did you want me to read the whole time? Like, so I'm not going to please everyone. And that is something that I have to internalize because I am a people pleaser by nature.
Same.
So that is something that I have to be like, all right, Rachel, you did a good job, but no.
Yes, I love
anytime.
No, but I love that you acknowledge I'm the same exact way that 99% was positive, but that 1%, man, because again, I think we are people pleasers and whatever, it sticks with you. And so, I mean, I totally get it. But yes, focus on the 99%. Remove the, like, even the interjection thing. Like, people, come on. And that's the thing is, you are actually a brilliant presenter. I could have listened to you talk for hours. You're so good at it. It's not only engaging, but so informative. And we just really appreciate you. So thank you so much.
No, I'd love to come back anytime you'll have me. And I hope to see you both in person at some point, maybe at the cabin.
Yes. Yes, at the cabin. We're going to Colorado.
Yeah. Perfect. Yay.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you for having me.